Accession number 9552, reel 9.
Mr. Basil Farrer, Reel 9. You were telling me about the soldier's court-martial, December 15.
And he was 6 months at the base prison, base military prison. That was it would be at Christmas time in December 1915. In April 16, conscription came out. He was immediately sent back to the battalion, because we were approaching, he was sent back, by April we were approaching the projected offensive, because the July wasn't fixed definitely. I think various dates had been fixed, I've read, since. We didn't know then, but he was sent back to the battalion and was a very disgruntled man. Normally, he wouldn't have gone over the top. And I have a true recollection that he was badly wounded himself in the attack on July. But what became, I didn't collect him, he wasn't in my company. Because when you go over with your company, your other company, and of course you collect the wounded there, then collect any York's wounded, but he was with another company.
Was there a lot of sympathy for the man in the battalion, when he was sent away, or?
I don't think soldiers express sympathy or otherwise about things like that. Soldiers took life and everything in its stride. I mean, misfortune, good fortune, they took it in its stride. I don't think there was any open expression of sympathy for him, no.
And he was one example of drunkenness on leaving Estemnes. Were there others? Was it a common thing, or was it?
Well, it could be when you're out in the village, because soldiers were not French wine.
Did you personally have any trouble when you were on this clearing Estemnes?
No, I was only on that duty once, and that was a few days before before I was appointed to stretcher bearer.
Now, when and where were you posted to the front line with the battalion?
Well, it would either be towards the very end of December or right at the beginning of January. I do remember the conditions were very... the weather conditions. There was snow, and it was a very, very nasty winter, that winter was. In fact, we were eventually issued with leather or sheepskin jerkins. But it would be the early, either very late December or early January. And we had been paired, and I think I mentioned that the Kitchener's army had been arriving in France, and we'd been taken, the 2nd Battalion Yorkshire Regiment, who were in the 21st Brigade, 7th Division, they were taken out of the 7th Division.
The whole of the brigade?
As far as we're concerned, two regiments, the 2nd York and the 2nd Wilts, came out together, were paired with two battalions of Kitchener's army, which happened to be a battalion of the Manchester Pals and a battalion of the Liverpool Pals. Their numbers, I think, the 23rd or 21st, 22nd, I don't know, I've forgotten the number of the Manchester Regiment and the Liverpool Pals, but they were the Pals battalions. Now, the Liverpool Pals paired with the Yorks, and the Manchester Pals paired with the 2nd Wills. What I mean by paired is, we did so many days in the front line, our paired regiment would be in reserve. Relieve at night, they'd go in the front line, and we'd be in reserve, alternatively. So we always paired with the Liverpool Pals, and the Wilts paired with the Manchesters. And We retained our brigade number, the 21st Brigade, but formed the new 30th Division. And the 30th Division, from then onwards, right to the Battle of the Somme, were on the extreme right of the British line, which ended at a place called, I think, Maricourt, and beyond that was the French.
So, do you know the actual names of the villages where you were sent?
Bray, that was the only village we knew, as far as I can recollect. There was, right behind, there was Amiens, some distance. No, Corby. Corby was halfway between Bray and Amiens. But I don't remember the Yorks ever being at Corby. I don't remember.
So would that be on the Carnoir?
Pardon?
The Carnoir.
Carnoir was merely a little hamlet. It was hardly a village. When I say that, there was nothing left. There was only just a few, what might have been farm buildings there. There was a sunken road. I remember that especially, that sunken road that went right away up right up to Montauban.
So this was the same sector you'd been in with the
13th? It was the same sector that I'd been in with the 13th Field Ambulance, except with the 13th Field Ambulance, I wasn't in the front line. I was never nearer than, I think, the bottom of what was referred to as, I've forgotten what that communication trench, but the hamlet of Carnoir, where the cow was found. There.
So, can you tell me about how you first reached your first trip to the front line, when you first went into the front line as an active service battalion, how you reached it and what were your first impressions when you got there?
Well, we'd marched up from Bray, across there's a road called from Albert to Peron, I think. Then the road goes down, the hamlet of Carnoir, and then the communication trench starts. And of course, when you take over trenches, that is, relieving troops that are in there, they come out and you go in. They don't come out until you're in. You've got to be in there first, of course. That all takes place at night, always. So I have no recollection of anything special beyond going along and march along with the troops up the communication trench, and then finding myself in the morning in the front line.
What was the situation of this front line? What could you describe its position in relation to the Germans and in relation to any major landmarks or features?
There was a clear in front of us. You didn't pop your head. We had what we call periscopes. Some made them, but some were really efficient. You could look. There was a glass here and a glass, and we could just. You hadn't to put them too far up, otherwise, the jellies would. Fire at them, you see, to destroy them. Yeah. From my recollection, the distance between the two trenches, and it could vary. I mean, there would be a couple of hundred yards at the most. In front of our trench, not immediately in front, but a few yards in front, would be barbed wire. And in the same in front of the jelly trenches, he'd have his barbed wire. And the trenches, of course, were obviously, as everybody I think knows, were not straight line, but they'd be I've forgotten the exact expression, but
crenellated. Crenellated. Traverses.
Yes. So, it's in the first place, to stop infilid fire, and again, if a shell fell in one little section, it wouldn't hurt those in the other. So, it was like that. And the dugouts...
Hang on, before we get on the dugouts, how deep were the trenches at this point? Roughly.
Roughly, well, there'd be a firing step. The firing step would be, say, 1 foot or 2 foot from the ground. And when you stood on that, you could rest your elbows to fire. So you couldn't see over the top. There'd be about 9 to 10 feet.
Would you have a built-up parapet and parados?
Sandbags. Sandbags.
How wide would the trench be? Were they sort of slit trenches or quite wide?
Oh, but the front line trench would be wide enough for one man to pass another.
So approximately a yard?
Yes.
There
not wider. And as I say...
Did you have...
There's a firing step, which you... where you sat most of the day and night time or stood.
What about duck boards? Did you have duck boards?
Duck boards, yes. Duck boards, they were... Especially because the trench is filled with water and when it was raining, the water perhaps could run away, but and all that, and snow, but duck boards. And particularly in the communication trench and things like that.
Did you have anything to keep the sides of the trench up? Did you use wire or wood or fretwork or anything? Or was it just naked earth?
Just naked earth, yes. The trench in which I've been.
Now, in front of the trenches, that you've mentioned the wire. How thick was the wire at this time, between January and, say, June 1916?
I couldn't say it with any truth.
Could
now.
You remember if it was a formidable barrier or was it was fairly token wire?
No, it could be nasty. It could be nasty to get through. I mean, if you were hit trying to get through, you hung there. And that was a nasty sight often to be seen after a night raid or an attack, men hanging on the wire dead. And it would be most... dangerous to try and get them even when dead to get them off, because Jerry would know they were there and that would be a point to shoot at.
Were there any, you know, you're in these trenches at Kanawha, was there any buildings or landscape points which would position you could tell me which would position
no,
you exactly
I don't
in
think, no there were, Kanawha was right at the bottom of this communication trench of some probably what shall I say I couldn't be out a quarter of a kilometre behind the front line. Kanawha itself was. There was this long communication trench which led to it, to the front line from Kanawha.
Had the area been well shelled, or was it pitted with shell holes at this time?
At that time, fairly. It had been held by the French, and it seemed to us that the French. It seemed to us, I'm not saying it was, that their policy was live and let live. You leave us alone and we leave you alone. Of course, when they had to attack, they attack.
But it had the reputation of a quiet sector.
It was a quiet sector. Particularly compared with Ypres, Givenchy, where you could use sort of even grenades, well, trench mortars and things like that.
Now, you mentioned the dugouts. Could you describe what were your accommodation arrangements within what dugouts there were?
Well, our dugouts in the front line were never below ground. When I say never below ground, I sort of just stepped down a few inches and in the side. And just hovels dug in there. With some with wood support and a bit of wood if you could to keep the thing from falling in, but they certainly were not shell proof, even a shrapnel. Our dugouts from up to the time I was there and in that particular area were merely shelter from in which you could sleep and shelter from the rain and things like that. They were not safe, whereas when we'd cross, when we did attack, compared with the German dugouts, entirely different.
Did you have any sort of, not door, but would you screen the opening of the front?
Yes, with sandbags, you know, the bagging. At night time, you would, because to light a candle or even to warm something. Although, I recollect there was some kind of little thing which give a very little light and which one could warm. Which people used to send, you know, the parents would send out to the troops little round things which you could light, and they gave a little heat, and you could put your your canteen on, and eventually, long, long time after, warm what was in, you know, what was in there. But it was dangerous to have any light, which would, especially at night time, which would reflect.
So these...
But of course, one smoked all day long, night and day, but not with your head above the parapet.
So these dugouts are pretty similar to the one you'd had at Railway Cutting?
Yes.
Would it be the same size for three people, or were they larger?
Oh, they varied. Some could be only for two or three, or some with four or five. But there were never in the front line any spacious dugouts.
Would you always, every time you came to the line, we'll discuss the rota later of in and out the line.
Yes.
Every time you came to the line, would you take the same dugout with the same people?
No.
So how were they allotted?
Well, as you moved along the trench in single file, turning, and your point would be the extreme and the next man, just as you'd formed up before you marched, went up the communication trench.
So it was just whichever came
yes.
first?
Yes, oh yes.
Were they always in the back of the trench, or would they be in the
mostly,
parados?
Mostly at the back.
That's the parados
yes.
side, not parapet.
Yes. And on occasion, when very rarely, I don't remember it really much at the front, because at the front you've got the fire step.
Of course, yeah. Would you make an effort to try and share with any special friend?
Oh, you can do it if you'd friends, yes, if you, you know, any particular pal. Now, the four stretcher bearers would be together. As I said, there's four stretcher bearers per company. You had to be together, because if you wanted so not to go and look down the trench, where's my pal and all that, we were always together.
So you four would often go in the same...
Yes, we would. Whatever dugout was available.
And this is, as before, is where you keep...
But of course, you're in the dugout. Now, I don't remember whether you... I have forgotten whether we went into dugouts at night, but otherwise you were in the trench. At night time, of course, you'd always a man in each traverse on duty.
So you just, as before, you just keep your personal kit in the dugout. Would you leave it in the dugout while you were doing anything else?
Well,
would you leave anything there?
You could leave your pack, but otherwise you never took anything off whilst in the front line.
You still didn't have a rifle as a stretcher bearer.
As a stretcher bearer, no. We ran them into the quartermaster stores when we were a stretcher bearer. But the men with the rifle would always be never whilst in the front line, be always fully dressed with belt, the five packages of ammunition, water bottle, haversack, and drenching tool. Always have those on, because I mean you could be attacked at any moment, particularly at night or any time. I mean you wouldn't have time. At night time, you'd sort of unloosen your belt to lay it. Well, we stretcher bearers, of course, didn't have all this paraphernalia. We'd quite enough to do carrying a stretcher without having all that. And your
so
pack.
What did you have then?
Well, we had our pack and everything except rifle and bayonet.
The next thing I'd like... Did you have anything else in the dugouts? Did you have any sort of facility or anything else you'd keep in the dugouts at all? Or were they just blank?
Just blank.
Next, I'd like to ask you about your rations and supply of rations. How would they arrive and how were they distributed every day while you were in the front line?
The ration part, they'd be brought up to a point at the bottom of the communication trench, say to the village of Carnoir, down the road from Bonfrey Farm, in transport. You see, the regimental transport. And there'll be a ration party from the front line, detailed, to collect the rations.
That would never be the stretcher bearers, would it?
No. Although it must have been, occasionally, because I remember being with a particular pal, whom I perhaps might mention later, who was killed. Who was a sniper, and I was on a ration party then when he was wounded. He was right in front of me when he got his third wound. His fourth was fatal. So I did have one. It did occasionally. It couldn't often have been on, because a stretcher bearer might be wanted if he was back collecting rations and there was a casualty. So he was generally excused those duties.
What can you remember about a ration party on the rare occasions you were on one? What would you do on a ration party then?
Well, collect in sacks bread, McConaughey rations, jam, and of course in the daytime they'd have Dixies with hot tea. Which had to be carried by two men along the communication trench.
How many of them would you be in a ration party?
Could be. Oh, really? I couldn't say whether a dozen. It could be six or half. Just depends what rations there were to be collected. And then, of course, the rum ration, and had to be brought up to the front line. Because rum...
I'll come to the actual parts when we get to... But so you'd carry this up. What about water? How did you carry water forward?
At the regimental, because there's a regimental headquarter post, you see. I mean, the headquarters of the regiment would not be in the front line. It would be in the reserve. And even the transport would not be there. Would be further back. And we had water tanks, so you filled your water bottle.
And you wouldn't get brought water in the line.
Only what you had in your water bottle. So whilst in the line, you had little opportunity of a watch, for instance, or anything like that.
When did the ration parties go back? At what time of day or night? When, and with what frequency?
Oh, every night.
So they went every night.
Yes.
That would be the main
of course,
ration.
They would also collect any post that had arrived. Parcels too. Parcels from England, you know.
So the ration party would go back at night. And then what about the... Would there be subsidiary small ration parties to bring up the tea in the morning? Would that be a separate ration party then?
Yes, I think so.
But they would just bring up the Dixie of tea, is that correct?
Yes. And also... Oh, really? I've forgotten whether... Dixie of tea, yes. And whether we... My memory's failed me completely of the composition of the... Whether bring up tea or even... Whether we were issued with... What do you call it? Mashes and stuff. Or a hot meal, anything like that. I've forgotten how they'll...
When the food was brought up, how was it distributed? So the ration party arrived at the front line. You're there already. So how did it get from the ration party to the troops?
My memory fails me there. It must have been... The rations were up. Well, frankly, don't remember.
Fair enough. We talked a little about some of the rations that you had while you were 13th Field Ambulance. Were they at this time... did they differ in any way in the front line as infantry? Did you get any different rations?
No. No, rations were sort of regulated. So much was allowed per... It was calculated on the number of personnel. That is to say, the number in the company... And the number in the regiment, and so on. I mean, a loaf, when there was bread, would probably be between, I think, four men. And I've forgotten, too, whether rations would be would come up every day, or whether you'd have them for the 4 days in the trench. I have really forgotten.
So you get the bully beef, the McConaughey's, the pork and beans, the jam, the same as you'd mentioned before.
Yes.
That was how... moving on, you didn't get water rations while you were there. That meant
not in the front line. No.
Did that mean you went thirsty or?
No, you've got a water bottle. You've got a water bottle, and that was part of your equipment.
And that was enough.
And that had to suffice.
What about special rations? You've mentioned one already, rum. So we'll look at that. How was the rum ration doled out?
I remember at the beginning, it was doled up by that officer. In your canteen, now, a canteen is a rather large you may have seen those army canteens. I don't know what they are now, but it fitted on the back of your belt there. And it had a lid with a handle on which you could fry things, and also that everything went into this canteen, your tea and everything. Now, you'd go with your canteen, and the officer, two spoonfuls was the ordinary, two large spoonfuls. I don't know what a spoonful about that size. What kind?
Like
of
a tablespoon.
Tablespoon. Two tablespoonfuls was the normal ration, because it was pretty hot stuff. Now, I don't remember whether we got it during the summer, but we certainly got it in the winter.
So you'd be having it between January and
yes.
June.
Now, I've forgotten whether we had it in the summer. And I think we, again, honestly, memory does fail to be certain. I mean, you can be confused now whether it's only memory, whether you got it before an attack. But I know you did. Yes, I think you got an extra spoonful before an attack, because it was fiery stuff. Now, what used to happen at the beginning, you'd roll your canteen out and go away. Now, of course, there were chaps who didn't drink in the army. They'd sell their ration of rum for cigarettes. A fellow would have an extra ration, and an extra ration of rum can make you drunk. So, when I joined them, you had to drink it in front of the officer. We'll label it in, and you had to drink it there. And that was issued at stand two in the morning. Because your stand two is every morning.
So you would... Did you take yours?
Oh, yes.
Did most people drink it?
Most, yes. I think so.
Well, you say it was fiery stuff. Did these two spoonfuls, would it have a noticeable effect on you? Would it?
It didn't make you intoxicated. But it was really fiery stuff, and you could feel it warm when you're down there. But an extra ration wouldn't make you intoxicated, but it could set your blood going more. You know, the adrenaline wasn't working more. Give you a little more Dutch courage, that's what.
You mentioned another special ration, so to speak, and that was cigarettes. How did you get a cigarette ration? Or did you get a cigarette ration, or was it privately?
Oh, no, I don't remember. We did get an occasional cigarette ration, because we used to get gifts from England. And I remember the South African free-issue ones, and it was a gift of the South African government. So it wasn't a regular thing. Not to my recollection. It might have been.
Did you smoke at that time?
I smoked, yes.
Where did you get your cigarettes from?
Well, one of the first things to the NAFI didn't exist, but the Salvation Army, they were very, very quick in the field with their tents, and there was another, the YMCA, I think, they had one. But there was no such thing, it was all private, there was no official place where you could buy these things. And I do remember the favourite cigarette of the troops was a Woodbine. And in those days, they were in you could get packets of five, a penny a packet of five. But the Woodbines, when you bought them in tins of 50, they were really good cigarettes. They were indeed. I remember those. And you could tell the difference between a Wills and a Player in those days.
Did you smoke before the war?
Yes.
Did many people seem to start smoking during the war? Because that's one of the things that's said about the war, that lots of people started smoking.
Yes, I mean, you're a wounded man, you'd light a cigarette and put it. A dying man, practically. It was a great...
You smoked a lot then?
A lot, yes. And we used to, when we had no money, we'd even play cards for cigarettes. And of course, we'd play Vingt-et-un, 21. That's like Vingt-et-un, like turning over. And there'd be a chap winning, he'd have a cap full of cigarettes. But when you'd smoked yours, you'd just have yourself out of the winner's cap. We'd play for anything.
Why did you smoke such a lot? Why did he smoke more, really, is what I want to know.
Well, I think it was something to do. Something to do. You couldn't just stand there or stand there all day long. Actually, in the front line, a soldier wasn't... There was no work to... Yes, you had to keep your trench in fairly good condition. If a shell had fallen there, you'd got